Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hi, I'm Donna Bridges, Senior Lecturer at Charles Sturt University. This month, we're talking about 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. This is an annual international campaign that occurs in November and December. This year, the theme is Unite, Invest to Prevent Violence Against Women and Girls. And I'm joined today by two experts in the area of violence against women. Paula Cahill is a generalist counsellor at Central West Women's Health Centre here in Bathurst. Paula has worked extensively with women experiencing or recovering from domestic violence, and she has experience working in the area of sexual assault as well. And you can find out more about Paula and about Central West Women's Health Centre online at www.cwwhc.org.au. My other guest is Dr. Rachel Hogg, who is a senior lecturer at the School of Psychology here at Charles Sturt University, and she's a member of our very own Gender and Feminist Studies Network as well. Rachel's contributed to academic and media discourse around wellness culture, sex education and consent, and domestic violence reforms. And you can find out more about Rachel on the CSU's School of Psychology website, or go to YouTube and search for her recent TED Talk called Disordering Distress. Now, just before we start, I will do a trigger warning. I want to acknowledge that this talk will cover sensitive and potentially distressing topics, including gender violence, sexual assault, and related trauma. So at any point, if you feel uncomfortable or triggered, please prioritise your well-being. And if you need support, please reach out to 1-800-RESPECT. For family and domestic violence counselling, New South Wales Rape Crisis Service 1-800-424-017, or please call Lifeline on 131114. Rachel, my first question is for you. Regional and rural areas have a reputation for high levels of violence against women and girls. Is it deserving of this reputation?
The short answer to this question is yes. But we do have data to suggest that women in regional and rural and remote areas are more likely than women living in urban parts of Australia to experience domestic and family violence. And we also know that when they experience it, they tend to have some different challenges. And these are not things that only occur in regional areas, but certainly the interconnectedness of regional and rural communities is a blessing, and it's also a burden when it comes to domestic violence. So we see a lot of regional women having quite high levels of fear of stigma and shame. They're very conscious of community gossip and what might be spoken about in the context of their relational experiences. And often people or perpetrators in these areas have a community reputation that is quite well established and does not coincide with any kind of question around that person's, you know, engaging in illegal or criminal behaviour. So the lack of privacy that rural and regional women experience is one factor, but we also see higher levels of conservatism in these areas and typically, you know, models of rural masculinity that do often reinforce particular forms of domination.
So definitely deserving of the reputation, but for complex reason. And also sounds like investing in that prevention is crucial. So Paula, this year's theme for the 16 Days of Activism is Unite, Invest to Prevent Violence Against Women and Girls. So when they say investment, what are they talking about? What does it mean to invest in prevention?
I think this is a really great question, because we know that when they have done studies into investing in prevention, that approximately $1 for every dollar that you spend on primary health prevention can save up to $8 or $9 in terms of costs down the line. So when we think about the costs to the community that domestic violence and family violence and sexual assault incur. There's a very real personal cost, but then there's a very big economic cost to our country every year because of these issues in our society. A lot of times we see investment going into things that are easy to measure. So if we think about a hospital system, we know how much a hospital costs. We know we can actually work out costings. Those costs are measurable and the outcomes are more clearly defined and measurable. So to invest in something like prevention is a lot more nebulous, and particularly when investing in something that, although we know we will save so much money down the track in just the health system alone in terms of how we have to fund responding to that violence and repairing some of that violence, it's much harder to define and measure. It's also an issue that our society would prefer somebody else deals with, frankly. So it's not something that is an easy investment to make. But we do know that by bringing these things out into the open, by making sure that we do have some funding for that investment in prevention, that we can have an impact.
So what is the Central West Women's Health Centre doing in terms of investing in prevention?
First of all, we have our individual counselling. We also provide supports to families. So we have a family counselling service. We do some case management and work with other services. But we're also trying to really work hard to expand our group programs as well. We know one of the first things that happens for women is isolation. We're trying to increase the opportunities that women have to find other people. We know that if we can increase the community around a woman, making sure that she and her children are less isolated, that they have more opportunities to connect with other people, that has a huge increased outcome in their health and well-being and long-term recovery. So we do group programs, and then also at a community level, we're reconvening our Bathurst Community Action Against Family Violence Network, and we're just in the planning stages for our march, which will kick off the 16 days of activism on the 29th of November.
It sounds like there's two things going on there. One is you're thinking about prevention, and the other is that you're dealing with the problems that are coming from the gendered violence. So investing in prevention then seems to be around investing in community, making sure people aren't living in isolation or living in poverty. Those two things, I noted, you said quite clearly lead to domestic violence situations.
When resources are limited, then that means that the opportunities and options for women and men in that space are also limited. So there's more likelihood of that stress and pressure building. And I guess I just wanted to draw on something that Rachel spoke about earlier in those archetypes of what it is to be a man. And I'd also add, you know, that idea that men are strong and silent, that they're resilient, that they're logical, that they're not emotional. So particularly in rural areas. So they don't talk about their problems. They don't get help for these things. It's the women often that are also trying to get help for the men to try and prevent some of these issues happening in their families. So I guess what we see when there's housing crisis is that we're increasingly getting generations of families that have to live together, or couples that are living separately under the same roof. And so that increases the complexity of the picture for everyone in that situation, because there's just not affordable housing, there's not that freedom and flexibility. So I have concerns about what that means for the level of violence.
Rachel, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, one about involving men, but also the campaign asking individuals to take action. I wondered if you can see any problems with a call to action to individuals.
I can see a number of problems, and one of the key problems is that this is already how we tend to approach so much of the harm that we experience, that people need to upskill themselves. The idea of a neoliberal society is that we are the architects of our futures, we are the architects of our own destinies, and that if we just harness the resources that we have, we put our mind to it, we can pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and change our lives, change our futures, change all kinds of realities. And this is a narrative, this kind of rampant individualism, really normalized, very celebrated. It's celebrated in mental health contexts where we talk about people, you know, just engaging and making an effort and healing themselves. There's an enormous amount of social media content now that revolves around how you can heal yourself. And often that is presented in a relational way. But even when we talk about psychotherapy, one of the things that we know in psychology is that one of the biggest single determinants of how effective therapy actually is for a person has to do with the client-therapist alliance. So basically, it has to do with relationships. It has to do with the connection between the therapist and their client. But when we see psychology sold to people, it's usually not really positioned in that way. It's positioned as a skills-based enterprise. And this is something that is really, really relevant for women. We see this all the time for women in the way that we position both medical and psychological and also domestic violence-related kind of concerns, that women need to find ways to extract themselves from the harm that they're presented. And this can be quite benign. So you can see on social media, there are lots of commentators who talk about how your attachment style might lead you to attract a certain kind of person. Now, I'm not discounting that certain patterns of that nature may exist, but one of the things that I'm often drawn to ask my friends when they talk about this is, if you think you are attracting emotionally unavailable men, perhaps we need to think about what percentage of the population is actually made up of emotionally unavailable men. And not overstate some of these patterns as some sort of horoscope that you're attracting this. And look, this rampant individualism is really critical in relation to men as well. So I wanted to circle back to some of the points that Paula was making around regional context, especially, first of all, in terms of isolation. And this is a good example of a contextual factor that is often overlooked when we emphasize someone's willpower as the key thing that's going to change their life. So we know that in particularly in farming communities, there are often much more complex financial arrangements and financial dependency is much more common. And it's often controlled by husbands and fathers. And sometimes women and in domestic violence in these circumstances are quite genuinely afraid to leave because of the fear of bankrupting the family farm or leaving their children without economic security. And they often have less access to, you know, streams of income that women in urban areas might have access to. So there's all kinds of contextual factors like this that suddenly become quite invisible when we focus very much on individual agency as the solution to this problem. Really, when you talk about prevention, Donna, I think we have to be going right to the baseline and even to what is going on, you know, for young boys who are preschool age.
I did read some arguments that including boys in discussions about domestic violence perhaps places an unnecessary burden upon them, and that there has been some awareness promotion that has included quite young boys. I agree, did seem inappropriate, but I do have the question, can we leave men and boys out of these discussions?
Look, I think one of the answers to this is we tend to get into these binaries where we either focus on the harm that patriarchy does to women or we focus on the harm that patriarchy does to men. And right now the cultural conversation is very centralized around the harm that patriarchy does to women. And there's a good reason for that. The patriarchy has been incredibly harmful for women and women are dying because of that. So we absolutely need to be having that conversation. But I don't think that it's necessarily helpful to exclusively have that conversation. And I understand the arguments, the concerns that some commentators have raised around the vilifying of young boys who suddenly feel quite vulnerable and attacked, or, you know, uncomfortable talking about things that may or may not be a reality for them. And of course, multiple forms of harm intersect in all of our lives all at the same time. And it is an uncomfortable but important reality to note that many perpetrators of violence themselves have experienced significant violence and trauma in their lives growing up. So I think we have to hold those multiple realities at the same time. But I think really the key thing here is to be communicating that patriarchy is a system that harms everybody. Stoicism is built into how we approach parenting young boys. From a very young age, we often cauterize men from a lot of their emotions.
Yes, very complex. If there is a dichotomy, you're either victim or perpetrator, it doesn't leave much space for men to create identities outside of that. So that does seem to be quite a restraint, our gender roles and gender perceptions in society. What other restraints are there, Paula, in terms of how the government's dealing with this issue in rural areas?
At the moment, I like to think about things as being a bit of Maslow. You know, if you don't have your basic needs being met, then our opportunity to build a healthy life is really limited. I think that concerns me that we're not doing more about policy levers in terms of particularly housing and cost of living at the moment. So one of the things that I've observed is that there's really big funding announcements into social housing, for example, which of course we support. But in order to access social housing, people actually have to go through quite a process of demonstrating that they are in need of it. So that means that you've got to identify yourself. You have to share a lot of personal information. You have to share that personal information more than once, and probably more with more than one agency as well. Then you're going to go onto a waiting list. Your situation is going to be assessed in comparison to other situations and priorities established. So there's a lot of resources that go into that. Whereas when we have a rental market that's more accessible for people, then there's a level of anonymity and empowerment and control that people can exercise about where they live. And that increases the mental load for women that are already struggling. And so in terms of government policy, I think that's got to be a starting point, that there's that control over some and accessibility over where people are living, and that we have a look at those policies that are driving that rental crisis and housing affordability. So I guess that's an example. Also, in terms of setting policy, I've heard recently about, on an interview on the ABC, about, you know, when I started working in the public service, for example, there was a separation between the ministry and the public service. So executives within the public service had, you know, they had usually risen up through the ranks. They had longer term placements. Now they're on contracts and they might be moved from one department to another. So they don't necessarily have to see the impact of some of the policy. And then particularly also in terms of having equity departments or equity investment in policy making as well. So, you know, there used to be investment in every government department about how policies would impact on women and children, and some of those positions or those departments or that research isn't happening anymore. So I think we really need to have a think about a campaign is important and awareness raising is important, but it's actually can be harmful if there's not opportunities and resources put in to supporting people once that awareness has been raised.
It certainly does seem that a needs-based funding model usually ends up with a lot of bureaucracy involved, doesn't it? You have to employ a lot of public servants in order to make sure the needs-based funding is getting distributed adequately, and then it takes longer to distribute it. In a recent seminar that we attended together, Paula, there was some talk about how difficult it is to understand women's health in rural areas. One of those health issues is associated with DV, and it did seem like a lot of the funding wasn't coming to rural and regional areas. A lot of the research wasn't being done out here.
Absolutely. And it is more complex to research in rural communities for a whole range of reasons. Yeah, that was a really interesting speaker, Professor Cassandra Serka, who was highlighting that that issue, that a lot of the medical research and health research only recently has incorporated a requirement to include women in their samples, which is quite shocking. And then, yes, if you examine that a bit more closely, then rural women's voices are largely absent from any of the research. Mm-hmm. And yet when we have a look at the population health data for women in rural and remote areas, the further west that you go, we know that that you're much more likely to have a whole host of health problems and less access to treatment than our urban counterparts. So we need that whole of community and society approach. We can't rely on the individuals, and particularly not the individuals that are already struggling with the burden of this trauma, of managing this trauma in their daily lives, to be able to affect the change.
Can I add to that? I just think that's such an important point that you've made. And I think that this goes back to what you mentioned before around individualism, Donna, because when we are measuring how we're measuring these things and the impact of funding really matters, because often individual outcomes are much easier and, you know, we can measure them quickly and quite efficiently. But to go to the more sort of structural factors and some of the complexities that we've spoken about today requires a longer term engagement. And I think we need to see that in the funding.
Good point. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you both. This has been a really interesting conversation. And I know that in rural areas, we need to raise awareness. So this is very informative and engaging for our listeners. Thank you. I'll just leave you with one more question. And that is there a message you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
One of the key messages that I would like to finish with today is to say that right now we're telling young men especially to work on themselves, but in the wrong ways. And we need to encourage them to think about connection rather than competitiveness. Right now, the emphasis in so many of the narratives that young men are confronted with is about how they can rise to the top. You know, one of the key things that you hear from Andrew Tate is that masculine life is war. And the idea of war is all about competition, right? Now, this is not about discussing whether or not men should feel threatened or not, or uncomfortable or not, when we talk about things like domestic violence. But the truth is that they do, and that affects how their brain processes information. And for us to break through that defensiveness, we do need to create some degree of psychological safety in these conversations. And I'm not suggesting that we need to sanitize things so that people who are causing enormous harm to other people feel comfortable and safe. But I am suggesting that this is a big, wicked problem, as our conversation today has illustrated. And for us to really unpack this and start to move forward, we do need to think about cultural change. And cultural change requires psychological safety. And where psychological safety is evident, people are able to think in much more complex ways. One of the things that often stops women from reporting domestic violence is that they at some point have been or feel that they have been complicit. So it's not uncommon for women to retaliate in certain ways, and that will often be held against them by the perpetrator. And so there's this level of mutuality, and we know that courts will often play on this, and that the police often have these sort of narratives of, you know, oh, look, it's takes two to tango is the kind of narrative which can erase the depth of the victimhood that the woman is often experiencing in those circumstances.
Thanks, Rachel. So what about you, Paula? Is there one message you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I guess in summary, I'd sort of say we hear a lot of talk about men hating, and I hate that term. We don't hear much talk about women hating, but I see a lot of both, really, which is unfortunate. So we need to move past those sorts of, you know, convenient labels towards something that's more about humanity supporting and community supporting and something that's more about collaboration and connection rather than this polarising individual sort of message of, you know, competition and war. So I guess if I was going to sum it up, maybe I'd say make love, not war. Consensually, please. With lots of consent.
Brilliant. Sometimes those simple statements can be the best ones, can't they? Well, thank you both for being with me today. I've really enjoyed it, and I know our listeners will as well.
Thanks very much, Donna.
Thank you so much. Great to chat with you both.
I'm joined now by my colleagues, Cliff and Sonia. Hi, Cliff and Sonia. So, 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, a very interesting talk. One of the things that's come up for us in our casual conversation is, does the patriarchy actually have the mechanisms within its institutions to support women who have experienced domestic violence or any kind of gender-based violence? And I don't just mean the government, I mean families, I mean religious institutions, any of the social institutions. Do they have those mechanisms, Sonia?
I don't think so yet, Donna. I love the fact that we are becoming more aware about domestic violence, especially over the last few years. It's more come to light. We're talking about it. I think people are more aware and it's getting news coverage and we're seeing a lot more about it. But on the other side, the flip side, we need to have those support structures in place because it's great to be aware of it and to start noticing it. And I think that is the first step. But we need to have the opposite happen as well, which is the supporting structures and the budgets from the government and the education in the schools at a young age and all of that kind of thing needs to happen on the opposite side as well to match it. You can't have activism without the support that goes with it for the people who become more aware after the or during the activism.
Yeah, it's important because this year's theme is about what are we doing. What did you think, Cliff?
Well, domestic violence, I think, is a very complex problem. You can experience domestic violence without the bruising as well. You know, you can have emotional abuse, you can have financial abuse. It is such a, like, it's this network of challenge. And the more I reflect on it, of course, there is a need for a systemic approach that really moves beyond this notion of physical violence and that provides care and support and acknowledges the various harms different forms of abuse can have. A couple of things that definitely struck me is within the rural context about the isolation that's there and how masculinity is constructed, given that male members are seen to don't access these services or don't access support services as much as they can or they should. How masculinity is within that environment also translates into potential violence in the home environment. At the same time, it also left me wondering, and coming from the Indian culture, what role can our family and the community around us play? You know, there is this tendency of Australian family and communities as being quite individualistic. Is there a role that our communities can around us play to provide that safety, and what training and support needs to be provided to them?
Well, they're all very interesting points, and I hope our viewers find this a really valuable conversation. Thanks for your comments, Cliff and Sonia.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by The Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google The Gender Network at Charles Sturt.